someplace in Pelican. Good evening. I hope you all made it through the elevator problems they were having. I want to welcome you to this co-sponsored program of the World Affairs Council Marines Memorial Association. I'm Jane Wales, CEO of the Council, and I'm delighted to see you. Before we begin, just a quick word about Marines Memorial. For those who don't know it well, it's a nonprofit organization. It's chartered to honor the valor and the memory of those who served, those who lost their lives in service of their country. And if you'd like to learn more about the organization and support the organization, please do check online, marineclub.com. The Council, as you know, is a neutral forum for discussing critical international issues of the day. We're a membership organization, and if you're not yet a member, you can join by going on worldaffairs.org. We are being recorded for radio tonight on KQED, so we want to give a special thanks to Jim Bennett, who's the recording engineer, and also take this as your opportunity to turn off your cell phones so that that is not what's heard on the 8 p.m. show on Monday night. Thanks a lot. During the format we're going to follow is that Secretary Cohen will be making formal remarks, then he'll join me for a conversation. That conversation will be informed by question cards from you. I will integrate the cards into what I hope will be a logical narrative, but if not, forgive me for the lack of logic. But I urge you to use your those blue question cards, and I urge you to use really good handwriting so I can include your questions. It's now my honor to introduce Secretary William Cohen. William Cohen served as the 20th U.S. Secretary of Defense. He served during the Clinton administration after having had a distinguished service in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives representing the state of Maine. While he was Secretary of Defense, he oversaw increases in defense spending as well as the reorientation of our military to adapt to the post-Cold War world. He also sought to address problems of recruitment and retention as well as strengthening security relationships with friends around the world, again, to help them encourage them to reorient their defense posture to take into account modern day needs. Under his leadership, the U.S. military conducted the wars in the largest air campaigns, really, in Serbia and Kosovo, and conducted military operations around the world. Since leaving the Department of Defense, Secretary Cohen has headed up an organization called the Cohen Group, which is a global business and consulting firm with offices all around the world covering issues as wide-ranging as he had to while he was in public service. He also launched the William S. Cohen Center for International Policy and Commerce at the University of Maine. He's here to discuss the global challenges facing the next administration, so please join me in welcoming Secretary William Cohen.
Thank you very much. And now that I'm told we're live, I'll have to be very careful in my my informal remarks that I delivered this evening. But President Wells, thank you for your kind comments. And ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this event. If you had trouble getting up, so did I. We blame it on Secretary Schultz, who's having an affair just one floor below us, but there was quite a turnout for one of our truly great public servants. I had the occasion to serve when I was in the House and Senate, and then at the when he was Secretary of State, had a very a great relationship with him, and I didn't even have a chance to say hello, but the elevator was packed, and so we were lucky to get up here, so hope you had hope you didn't have to walk up. Thanks. Boris Melnikov is a young man over there who spent years with me in Washington. Then he decided to find his fortune and go west, and he's here tonight. Boris, good to see you, and wish you well in the great state of California. Whenever I don't get to San Francisco very often, but I always feel a little bit like Henry Ford. You know, Ford, after he made all of his millions, he wanted to go back to his fatherland in County Cork, Ireland. And, of course, his reputation for wealth had long preceded his arrival. So when he finally got there, the town officials, they came to him and asked him, as normal the case, for a contribution to their local hospital. And Ford was quite accustomed to being touched in that fashion. And he pulled out his checkbook. He made a check out for $5,000. And then the next day in the local paper, it said in big, bold print, Ford contributes $50,000 for the construction of a local hospital. So the town officials came rushing back to him. They said, oh, Mr. Ford, terribly sorry. This was not our fault. It must have been a typographical error. We'll be happy to see to it the retraction is printed in tomorrow's paper. And Ford said, wait a minute, I think I have a better idea. He said, you give me one wish, I'll give you the balance of $45,000. That's one of those offers they couldn't refuse. So they said, it's done, whatever you want. He said, I want, when the hospital is finally completed, to have a quote over the entranceway taken from a source of my choice. So they said, it's done. He made the check out. The hospital was built. It's there today. And it has a plaque over the entranceway with a quote taken, I believe, from the book of Matthew. And it says, I came unto you as a stranger, and you took me in. So I come unto you a little bit as a stranger tonight. Hope you'll take me in. Not quite that fashion. I think a central issue for us to discuss tonight is what's the role of government in our lives? That's what's going on with the presidential debate. What is the role that government should play in our daily lives? It's a worthy debate, to be sure, and you have two different approaches, basically two different philosophies, at least on the domestic side. We'll talk about the foreign policy side perhaps in a moment. But when you talk about government, I always go back to Warren G. Harding. I pluck his name out of the pages of yesteryear, and Harding said that government is, after all, a very simple thing. And some years later, FDR said there never was a more pathetic misapprehension of responsibility than Harding's superficial conclusion, because we know it's not very simple, it's pretty complicated. And then it was Ronald Reagan, if I can embrace Governor Reagan and President Reagan, who said that government is like a baby's alimentary canal. It has a healthy appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. And I thought that was a pretty good definition in terms of where we find ourselves today, in terms of fiscal irresponsibility. It's something that I dealt with when I was a member of the House and the Senate. In fact, I gave my swan song. My final speech in the Senate was about the issues confronting us. And the central issue for me at that time was fiscal irresponsibility, that what we were doing, we were engaging in what I called basically fiscal child abuse, that we were inflicting, pain and suffering upon the generations that we don't see at this point but are going to feel those bruises in the years to come in the way of having to pay off that debt. And so fiscal responsibility is not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It's something that we should be concerned about as Americans. So how do we sustain this? And you can't be strong abroad if you're weak at home. I mean, that's the central issue that we're trying to figure out now, is how do we restore a sense of fiscal sanity to our policies so we can re-energize the American economy and then be the force for good throughout the world? And that's a role that we have to play. And so I want to talk a little bit tonight, and I won't go too long because I am a former member of the United States Senate. As you know, they have unlimited time allotted, that as long as you can stand on your feet, you have the floor. Unlimited debate. So I will try not to do that. I have that temptation, and it apparently runs in the just part of the job. I thought I might talk a little bit about what is the role of the United States in the world. And when I was at the Pentagon, for example, we had to decide what should be the role of the military. And I was very conscious about a book that was written by Richard Haass at that time. It was called The Reluctant Sheriff. And I felt that that was really the role that we needed to be, a reluctant sheriff, very reluctant to commit our fine young men and women into, put them in harm's way unless it was absolutely essential. I wanted to be reluctant, and we pursued that policy basically for the 4 years that I was there. 9/11 came along, and that changed things. Suddenly, we had a different foreign policy, a different policy toward going after on a preemptive basis. I know Governor Schwarzenegger has a new book out called Total Recall, but he was the Terminator. And we had something of that Terminator mentality at that point. We got to go after them wherever they are. Well, that has some consequences, as we know, both in Iraq and still in Afghanistan. And we have learned the limitations, actually, of the use of military power. It's not absolute. And just because we're still the strongest military in the world, there still are limitations on what we can do with that power. So we're finding that out as we have gone through a very expensive and very heartbreaking experience for a lot of people. So what is our role today? We're not a reluctant sheriff. We're no longer in the Terminator mood as a mentality as well. But are we part of an international posse? You know, we're just one member of this international posse that's charged with trying to maintain stability in various parts of the world. And, of course, President Obama has been criticized by Republicans as, quote, leading from behind. Frankly, I think he handled it correctly as far as Libya was concerned. You had another Republican called Bob Gates. And Bob Gates, when the issue first surfaced, he said, we don't have a national security interest in what was going on in Libya. But along came our British friends and the French, who said, but we do, and we need your help. And of course, the French and the British have been with us on every occasion for that we've been involved with. So there was pressure for the president to get engaged in Libya. And we did it in a way that we utilized our main strength, and that is our technology. No one else has the technology that we do. They don't have the stealth capability and the ability to take down air defenses in the fashion that we do. So we played a major role in helping to bring that about, even though the French and the British were the ones who were, quote, in the lead. We were really in the lead as far as the military operation was concerned. Then we turned it over to NATO. And we turned it over to NATO, and what happened? They ran out of ammunition pretty quickly, which raises another issue altogether in terms of the contributions that our NATO allies are making to the collective security of NATO itself. But that was one issue where we got to decide, what's our role in the world today? And exactly what kind of world are we talking about? It's changed. It's really changed rather significantly in the last 10, 15 years. Tom Friedman likes to write about this, but he, in one of his books, The World is Flat, he talked about how Columbus, thinking the world was flat, set out to sail to India, and he ended up here. And he found out the world was round. Friedman said, well, back in 2004, he flew to India, and he found that the world was flat. And it's both round and flat, that technology has actually flattened the world in the sense that now everybody has access to the phones we just turned off and has information in their hands. And so what that has done, in Friedman's word, it's allowed people the world over to cooperate, to collaborate, to compete, and to, quote, innovate. And that has both good news and bad news. On the positive side, we look at this thing, this is magic. I mean, when I was growing up, if you had access to the encyclopedia, you were doing pretty well. And if you had a whole set yourself, you were really doing well. Now you've got it in your hand. You've got all of the information that we once struggled to go to a library to take out cards and sign out books. We now have it in our hands. So on the positive side, you have it right here in California, Silicon Valley. That's the promise. You've got Samsung, and you've got Microsoft, and you've got Oracle, and you've got all of these brilliant information technology engineers, and they are producing miracles. They're producing miracles with that technology. The downside of it is that because the world is now flat, the same people who have access, the Bill Gates who creates this information, one of them, same information is in the hands of bin Laden, the bin Ladens of the future. So that's the world in which we live. Because it's now flattened, we now have a different world to contend with. And so we have to find a way to reconcile what our role is going to be in a world that is shifting in terms of power, in terms of the Arab Spring, now Arab Fall, in terms of the Muslim world, in terms of the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. So we've got a different world to contend with now, and we have to try and reconcile what our role is going to be. And frankly, I don't think we have any choice but to remain engaged. Now, when I heard Governor Romney today, he gave a very fine presentation, I thought. But it sounded pretty close to where President Obama has been. Minor differences, but nonetheless, there was almost a Kennedy-esque element to it. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to it today or to see it, but it was one that's pretty broad. You remember, I was influenced when I was in law school by JFK, and I remember when he gave his inaugural address. let every nation know whether they bear us well or ill, that we will pay any price, we'll bear any burden, endure any hardship, defend any friend, oppose any foe in order to ensure the success and survival of liberty. Wow, that was breathtaking. Could we say that today? Would the American people endorse that today? Because that pretty much was what was said today in terms of not quite so grandiloquent in terms of its scope. But I think that Governor Romney was laying out a case, which I think was a positive one in the sense that there are elements inside my party that are very isolationist. There are elements that say, time to come home. Forget about the rest of the world. Let's take care of, let's have some nation building right here at home. And so there are elements of pulling and tugging on that to say, let's take care of us first, and then we can worry about the world. And I thought that Governor Romney's statement today was pretty broad, saying, no, we have to remain engaged in the rest of the world. And we can't walk away from the world because the world is not going to walk away from us. It's that simple. And so bad things happen when we're not engaged. And the question is, what form does that engagement take? With President Obama, he's tried to approach it more on the diplomatic side, backed up by a strong military. I think Governor Romney wants to be much more aggressive on the military side as opposed to the diplomatic, but it's hard to say at this point. But we have no choice because we can't come back to continental United States and wrap ourselves in a cocoon and watch the world unfold on CNN or MSNBC or Fox. Not going to happen. So engagement is a requirement, and the question is, how do we deal with the world that's shifting and changing? We have less influence in the world than we did 15, 20 years ago. That's the reality. And there's not much you can do about it, say, to Egypt, to dictate to Egypt. They've had an election. They've got a new president. They may have new policies that we'll have to see how it unfolds in Egypt. But it's not going to be the same relationship we had in the past. We will not have as much influence, influence as we've had in the past. On the one hand, that may, in the long term, may work out to our to the betterment of our relationship. They're struggling now to, quote, put in place or institutionalize rule of law, trying to have some sort of code, commercial code, et cetera. But you've got to have institutions to build, because what's happening in Egypt can be reflected in other parts of the Middle East as well. You've got highly educated people who have no jobs. And so those are the people who went to the square. In Tahrir Square, that's what we saw, young people out there demanding an overthrow of an authoritarian figure. But they wanted something more. They want what we want. We want to have an economy that produces jobs for our young people and our people who are in the workforce and can hopefully we can retire and enjoy the rest of our lives. They want the same thing. So unless the Egyptian government, the president, and you know, his leadership, unless he's able to generate that, there's going to be even more turmoil in the region and in other parts of the Middle East. So how do we cope with all this? We won't have as much influence. On the other hand, we still have to have some influence, so we still have to be engaged with the Egyptians. And it's not going to be, they won't say, make the statements that we may want them to make. They may not have the same relationship with Israel that we'd like them to have. The president of Egypt will have to figure that out in terms of whether or not he wants to really find a way to stabilize his country and have a stable relationship with Israel and the rest of the neighborhood. That's going to be his choice and his people's choice. So we don't have as much influence that we can say, you have to do this. We can try and shape the philosophy and the economy of other countries, but we can't dictate it. And that's what has changed. So how we go about dealing with Egypt, Syria is another major issue on the agenda at this point. Do we support the resistance in Syria? The answer is yes. Have we done so with what? Humanitarian assistance, intelligence? We have not poured arms into the region at this point because there are some pretty serious reservations about what that would mean. Certainly you have the Iranians playing a role. Their hand is there. The Russians certainly have a role. They've been providing the arms all these years to the Syrians. Lebanon is also involved. Now Turkey may be involved. So it gets very complicated and requires a lot of diligence on our part to try to assess what the best course of action for us is. Let me say a couple of words about, well, Iran. Iran is obviously one of the central issues that are going to confront, that's confronting President Obama, confronting us, and will confront Governor Romney should he be elected. There aren't any good options with Iran. There are only three basic options. One, intensify the sanctions that we have been imposing, trying to generate as much international support for those sanctions to try to persuade the Iranians that it's not in their long-term interest to pursue a nuclear weapons capability. That's what we're doing now. Second option is to either encourage or take military action, either allow the Israelis, we have no choice over that, if the Israelis decide they want to go, they will go. But the question is, do we go with them or do we go instead of them? Military action. Well, it has a lot of untoward consequences that we know, that things can unfold from military operations which can prove very damaging to us globally with the reaction that could be produced not only in the region but throughout the Muslim world. So that's something you have to take into account. What are the consequences for that? And the third option is live with an Iranian bomb. Now, I will say from my perspective, the notion that Iran would ever launch a military attack or a nuclear attack upon Israel is pretty far-fetched if you're talking rationally on it, which may not be the case, because they would be destroyed almost immediately. The Israelis would respond overwhelmingly. There would be a retaliation would be devastating. Secondly, if they ever tried it against us, we know that what the reaction would be. So I don't see that as the major threat. The major threat is one of proliferation, namely if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, the other countries in the region also would have to have the nuclear weapon for deterrence purposes. So the Saudis, maybe the UAE, certainly Egypt at some point. So now you've got more and more countries having access to nuclear technology and materials. The chance of that getting out into the hands of the radical groups becomes greater, putting us all in danger. So that's really the key element. Do we try to contain the spread of nuclear weapons, or do we say, well, everybody's entitled to one? And I think that's not a good option. So those are the only three options. I think we're pursuing the best one at the moment. And I think the president has been right to say, let's go as far as we possibly can on the diplomatic side and economic sanctions and try to persuade the Russians and the Chinese that it's in their interest to really intensify the sanctions against Iran, because they say publicly, and I believe them, and they say privately to me, they don't want to see Iran get a nuclear weapon. Okay, well, now's the time to take this action so it doesn't become a military operation. But that's one of the real dangers involved. Let me turn quickly to China and to the Asia-Pacific region. Again, there was a notion, Governor Romney talked about, that the Europeans may be feeling abandoned, that we're, quote, pivoting to the Asia-Pacific region. Number one, I've never liked the word pivot. Number two, I don't like rebalancing. And three, I don't like that we're coming back to the Asia-Pacific region. We've never left. We've been there since World War II. And as a result of our being there, that region has been stabilized. I ran into this back in the 90s and when there were a lot of white papers coming out saying it was time for the United States to get out of the Asia-Pacific region, that it was time for the Asians to take care of Asia. And I went and I addressed the Chinese Military Academy. I said, you really mean that? You want us to leave tomorrow? And if we do, what happens? Nature abhors a vacuum. So does geopolitics abhor a vacuum. Who fills it? Are you going to fill the security arrangement for all of the Asia-Pacific region? Do you think that Japan will sit on the sidelines? India will sit on the sidelines? You will have great instability. And what happens when you have instability? Money takes off. Capital's a coward. Capital takes flight. All of this tremendous economic reform that you have enjoyed has been the result of us being there, frankly, and we're going to continue to be there. One final thing on China. The issue is the so-called ASEAN countries, the Asian countries, Southeast Asia, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. They want us to have a bigger presence, not bigger in the sense of more military presence as such or bases. They want us to show that we're more engaged in the region. Why? Because, number one, they are trading with China. They are the number one trading partners with China. We used to be. We're number four now. We used to be number one. But they want to continue to do business with China, and they will be doing more business with China. They don't want to be dominated by China. So they would like the United States to continue to show that we have a presence. And the president's plan, so-called pivoting or rebalancing, means that we'll show a little more presence by putting 2,500 troops, Marines, in Darwin. Now, that's not going to result in a major balance of power shift with 2,500 Marines. I think the Marines are great, and I'm in a wonderful institution right here, and the Secretary of State is just down below us, also a former Marine. Marines 2,500 is not going to mark a shift, but it does send a signal. And the fact is we're going to have a few more ships rotate through Singapore. Not major combat ships like aircraft carriers or 688-class submarines, big boomers as we call them, but a more of a presence. We're doing some more negotiating now about the Philippines. Vietnam, ironically, would like to have us have a lot more presence in the region. Why? Because the Chinese are getting stronger. That's inevitable. That's what Deng Xiaoping had always planned for, four modernizations, the last one being the military. So they are growing economically. They're number two economically. They're scheduled, if things continue on their current path, which is not a guarantee, to be number one economy in the next 20 years. It may or may not take place, but they are building their economy and they're building their military. And that is what is of concern to the other countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region, that they're now starting to flex some of the muscle that they've been developing. And they would like the United States to have a little more presence there. And that's what the presence program is really all about. So we say that rhetorically, but then you look down at the numbers on the budget. I don't see the budget there. So then what's the reality? And this is something that Governor Romney has been addressing, saying, okay, we want to have a greater shipbuilding capacity. I'm from the state of Maine. We build ships in Maine. So that's something that certainly is well received in the state of Maine and elsewhere. But then the question becomes, how do we pay for it? How do you reconcile spending more at the same time you're talking about getting control of the debt and the annual deficit, which is running 1.2 to 1.3 trillion a year? So these are the complex issues that we have to resolve, but our role in the world has to be one of engagement. There's just no walking away from that. So China becomes both an opportunity and a challenge. There's a great market there, as the Chinese have lifted some 450 million people out of desperate poverty. You can see it along the Gold Coast of China, as we call it. Inland, they've got desperate poverty, some 700-800 million people who still live very close to the impoverishment level. And so they've got a challenge. How do they raise that many people up into a middle-class society? Is that good for us? Well, there's an opportunity. They need infrastructure. They need things that we produce. So there are opportunities for American and Western business as well. Challenges to make sure that the Chinese, as they grow stronger and become more militarily capable, that they don't use that military in a way to intimidate or threaten the other nations in the region. Therefore, there's an interest for us to strengthen our relationship with the Australians, with our small force in Darwin, to have a bigger or more frequent presence in Singapore, to perhaps get back into the Philippines, to strengthen our relationship with Japan, and also to build a stronger relationship between the United States and India. All of that is designed to make sure that the area remains stable. Now, the Chinese, as they look at it, would say, wait a minute, it looks to us like containment. What you're doing by putting a base down here, putting another base here, you're really trying to contain us. And the reality is that we can't contain China. It's too big, it's too strong, and it's simply not doable. What we can do is persuade them through diplomacy, through our economic relationship, and that's why it's real important to have a good relationship with China, because both countries understand that if we work together on some of the major issues, we can benefit. The last thing we want to do is start engaging in a real hostile relationship with a country like China or with Russia or the two of them, which is another issue coming up in the campaign. Let me cease and desist here because I feel that I'm getting into my senatorial mode. Let me conclude with just a couple of key rules for me, at least, as far as conclusion is concerned. Freedom cannot exist without order. And pretty simple, a river without a bank is not a river, it's a flood. So we have to have freedom, but we have to have some order. And that's both fiscally, especially fiscally. Liberty cannot become license. We can't take our liberty to the extent that there are no rules any longer, that anything goes, that the rule of law is simply subsumed by whoever happens to dominate at that particular moment. Diplomacy can't be effective without a strong economy and without the military power to back up the diplomacy. And the world can't be safe without the rule of law. Those are pretty key elements that I think, at least for me, must be resolved as we move forward. And I would hope, once this campaign is over, which has gone on for the past 3 or 4 years, that we can find a way to reconcile differences. I must tell you, one of the reasons I left public office, I served 24 years on Capitol Hill. And the last few years became disappointing to me. We were spending more time in quorum calls, delays. It was simply not an institution that was, I found, fulfilling at that point because we weren't doing anything. We were more interested in posturing against the other party than actually dealing with the issues confronting the country. And I just decided that I am half Irish, and I have this internal clock that's always ticking, or the sands running through the hourglass in my mind. And I said, well, I've got so many good years left, and I think I'd rather try and do something beyond the political realm to do something. And then, ironically enough, I had retired. I was on my way. I had just signed a lease for a business office in downtown Washington, got a call from the White House saying, would you like to have president, to have lunch with the president? And frankly, I didn't know him. I had shaken hands with him on several occasions. We said hello to each other, but we really didn't have any kind of a friendship or relationship. And I had 2 meetings with him, and then he basically offered me the chance to become Secretary of Defense. And I must tell you, out of 31 years of public service, the last 4 as Secretary of Defense were the most rewarding, the most exhilarating, the most exhausting in the best years of my life. And tell you that because being in that position with the men and women who serve us, it's the most incredible experience that I could never hope to replicate in my lifetime. And being with them, being near them, it was to be inspired by them, to see their dedication, their patriotism, their selflessness, their initiation, all the things that make this country great. You see it in our young men and women who are serving us. So. I am always grateful to President Clinton for that opportunity. He took a bold step, never been done before, in terms of asking somebody from an elected official from the different party to come and serve in that capacity. And it worked out, I think it worked out well for both of us. Thank you very much.
And we've got the microphone over there. While you're putting on your mic, I should note that one of the questioners asked about how to improve the climate in Congress and noted that when you were there, it was more collegial. She or he seems to be implying that there's a connection between your presence and collegiality.
Well, it was starting to deteriorate, actually. I started in the House way back in 1972. I see all these young people here, and it's I should tell you, I went back to my 50th college reunion this past spring, and my oldest son will turn 50 in February. And so when I say I started way back when, and actually I don't know if it's in the program, but I actually ran for office by walking. And I walked all the way from New Hampshire to Canada on foot. And I stayed with different people, picked at random in their homes in the evening. And what I decided to do was I was going to make myself available to every single family, regardless of their political affiliation. So there's an area in Maine, in Lewiston, Maine, by way of example, that heavily Democratic, probably 90%. And I know when I started to campaign there, my Republican friends said, what are you doing? You're wasting your time. And I said, no, it's not a waste of time. And no Republicans ever won there. But I said, who are the people in Lewiston? They were Franco-American, heavily, Catholic, hardworking, labor force, who had probably never seen a Republican spend any time with them. And I went there, and I spent time in their homes. I talked to them. They have the same values the Republicans had. They loved their family, loved their country, loved their jobs, wanted to work, had strong religious ties. And I said, well, that's who we're talking to. And so I didn't carry the city of Lewiston my first time. A couple of times after that, they voted for me. So it's just basically making yourself open to people, listening to different ideas. I've always taken the position as a public servant. If a Democrat has a good idea, I want to embrace it. If Republicans do, I want that too. And that's the way I tried to conduct myself in those 24 years. But then I found what was taking place in the last few years. It was becoming much more partisan. And let me give you an example. The word today, compromise, has been poll tested. You will not hear public officials or politicians use the word compromise today. Why? Because it signals weakness. It signals lack of principle. So they use a different phrase now. It's called, let's search for common ground. Okay, whatever we call it, that's what has to be done. That's not what's being done. And each party is planting its flag in the concrete of absolutism, that you're either on the left or you're on the right. And my fear, what is taking place in our system, is the middle is being hollowed out. People who are willing to put their hands across the aisle and say, okay, let's make a deal. I can't have everything that I want, but you can't have everything you want. Let's find something we can both live with. That process has been in jeopardy. And anybody who's been willing to reach across the aisles had it cut off. You've had people like Senator Bob Bennett, really very strong conservative, really responsible conservative. His father was a senator. He was a businessman. He then became a senator, one of the best. He supported TARP. That was it. Got rid of him out of the party. And, Richard Lugar, a great internationalist. Now, he had the age factor working against him, but it wasn't the age so much as he was too willing to compromise on foreign policy issues. So if we do this, we end up basically almost with a parliamentary system without having a parliamentary system. And so we've got to come back to the center. I think that's what Governor Romney, frankly, is trying to do right now. I mean, if you look what happened during the primaries, and this is not unusual, candidates in both parties, Republicans move to the right, Democrats move to the left. And then once they get elected, you have to get closer to the center. If you're a Democrat, it's left of center, not far left, but left of center. If you're a Republican, right of center, but not far right. That's where you govern, somewhere around between the 40-yard lines. You know, that's where you have to try to make accommodations because we're a tremendously diverse country with different people, different ethnicities, different religions. So you've got to find a way in this great diversity of ours to make it work. And I think that right now we're at the polar extremes, and I think that that Governor Romney is trying to get back to slightly the right of center. And I thought he did a pretty effective job the other night. Frankly, the president was not on his game, and Governor Romney was. And I thought the speech today was an effort to say that he wants to be an internationalist. He's rejecting the far right that says, let's get out of foreign entanglements. Let's go back to what the founding fathers. It'd be great if we could do that, except this is a different world. So, yeah, we're involved in entanglements. And we, I think, are still the only force for good that has the capacity to bring about positive reactions. I think a world without the United States is one that's going to be fairly chaotic and not one we want to see. So we have to be engaged, and the question is, how do we reconcile that with our budgetary problems? We have to reconcile ourselves to the point that we'll be doing less with less. You can't do more with less. We're going to do less with less. Now, can we do that? Yeah, we can do that. We'll have to do that. So we have to then pick and choose. Where do we become engaged militarily? Where do we look for other ways to have an influence and shape events? So we have to be more discreet in terms of committing ourselves to long-term campaigns without understanding what the full consequences are. So would I like to have more for defense? Any Secretary of Defense will tell you, but it's not how much money you spend for defense, that's important, but it's how you spend it. What are you spending it on? What's the future likely to look like? And something, I'll get a little technical here, but QDR, Quadrennial Defense Review, you go through it every 4 years. You try and identify what are the threats that are coming at us today, the ones that are likely tomorrow in the next 20 years. And once you try to identify those threats, then you say, how do we shape our force structure to deal with that? So that goes on every 4 years where you make these kinds of analyses and projections. Anyway, I'll stop here and it was partisan when I left. It's worse now.
So let me hang on to the kind of issue that would appear in the Quarterly Defense Review, the whole issue of cybersecurity,
right.
a modern-day problem. I'm still with the issue of inability to compromise. The U.S. Senate failed to act on the cybersecurity bill. Mm-hmm. It was brought down, in essence, by a filibuster. Mm-hmm. Here's a national security priority, an economic security priority. Say a word about that.
It's perhaps one of the greatest threats that we face. I have always believed that a nuclear exchange would be the worst nightmare that any of us could encounter. In fact, I wrote a novel that came out last fall, paperback out soon, called A Blink of an Eye, in which I have a nuclear bomb that explodes and destroys the city of Savannah, Georgia. And the president then has to decide within about a 4 or 5 day period, who did this? How could they have done this? Why would they do it? And what do we do about it? Just to try and dramatize the issues that confront us on the nuclear side. But nuclear, and any Secretary of Defense, any president will tell you that's our worst nightmare is a nuclear exchange because of the devastation that would be involved. Second, of course, is biological warfare, but I put cyber warfare up there with all three of them now as the big three, because you can, with brilliant minds, shut down our infrastructure. And the problem is, it's not so much the government. Most of the infrastructure is in private hands. So it's the private sector that has to be, number one, alerted to what the dangers are, number two, then has to work with the government to say, what do we do to enhance our capability against this kind of intrusion that's taking place on a scale that's unimaginable today? So to me, the cyber threat is so significant that it was irresponsible to simply walk away and say, we'll get to it next spring. Because number one, if President Obama is reelected, then, well, he still has his national security team involved. But then the question is, what's Congress look like, the composition? If you have Governor Romney becomes president, he's got to have a whole new team. They have to go through the whole process to put that in. So now we're 6-8 months away. I don't think we can wait that long. I think it was irresponsible, and I think we've got to get back to that as a major threat that confronts us.
So let me take a series of issues, because as you noted, Governor Romney gave a major foreign policy address today. In the debate, the first debate, mm-hmm. Jim Lehrer asked, do you differ? How do you differ? So I'm going to go through a few and ask you that question,
sure.
As you've observed both candidates. When it comes to Syria, both candidates support having the Saudis and Qatar arm the rebels. Is there a difference between their views?
I think that Governor Romney went further on that issue, although not well defined in terms of providing weapon assistance to the Syrian resistance forces. Didn't say that we would provide the weapons, but that weapons should be provided. I think that, frankly, that's being done by others, at least at the smaller level. I don't know that he's prepared to commit us to committing major weapon systems to the Syrian force at this point. So I'm not sure there's that much of a difference.
So the president's concern with regard to heavy weapons is that they'll fall into the wrong hands. Do we know what is the composition of the rebel forces?
It's mixed. There are some elements of al-Qaeda involved, much as there were even in Libya. So there are people who are looking for ways to take advantage of that. So you have Sunnis who certainly want to see the Shia influence reduced. You have elements coming in from Iran who are now fighting against the Syrians. You have the Lebanese involved. So we don't have there's not a cohesive fighting force at this point. So I think there's some, that's one of the reasons why we're providing intelligence and along with humanitarian assistance to try to make sure that if we're providing weapons to elements that they're not going to be turning around and falling into the hands of terror groups or being used against us. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very reluctant. I mean, I think the president is wise in terms of Syria, in terms of not committing us to war in Syria, just as it's wise not to commit us to war with Iran until you reach the absolute endpoint of diplomacy and economic sanctions. We've got two. We just got out of Iraq. We're still in Afghanistan. We spent $1 trillion in Iraq. We're there close to that. We'll have spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. So as we look at what we're doing to our own military, I mean, look at the kids who are serving us. They're having five tours. We're taking a small group of American people who are serving in this capacity, and they're overutilizing them. So we've got to take care to make sure we don't undermine this great military. The greatest military in the world today is still the U.S. military, and we want to make sure that we husband that military in a way that doesn't overcommit them. And I know there's always this issue. Before you ever commit military force, there are two or three questions you have to ask. Number one, what is the mission? Specifically, what is the mission? Before I send your son or your daughter to put their lives on the line, I want to know what the mission is. Is it achievable? Number one, can I define it? Number two, is it achievable? Number three, what are the costs? Blood and treasure. Number four, what's the exit strategy? How do we get out? Because we know one thing, once you commit to an engagement, real easy to get in, real tough to get out. So those are issues that we have to always weigh, whether we're talking Syria, Iran, any country. We have to ask those questions, and we haven't been asking them enough, I think. I think the president is right. I don't think that Governor Romney disagrees with that. I think he's rhetorically sounds like there's a difference. I don't think there's much of a difference other than I think what he is saying, let's be more aggressive, let's get respect, and rather have respect and fear than weakness through diplomacy. But I think we've learned that there are limitations to our power. And so we can use it, but we have to use it in the right way. And anyway, I'll stop there.
You've taken us to Iran. So this questioner asks whether war is inevitable with Iran. I'd ask a more long-term question. Is Iran a status quo state? Were it to acquire a nuclear weapon, would we imagine it would be for deterrence purposes only, or do we imagine a more aggressive role?
Rule number one, nothing is inevitable until it happens, okay? Nothing is inevitable. We are still in charge of events and things that are not totally out of our control. So nothing is inevitable. Number two, Iran is a revolutionary state. They are not going to be satisfied with just maintaining the status quo. The reason that they're maintaining their power is they're revolutionary, and they want to spread that revolution to other parts of the region. As a result of what's happened in Iraq, Iraq is closer to Iran than before. They were at war at one point, and we were actually helping them against Iran. Now the barriers are down. President Maliki is closer to Iran. The Iranians have a bigger influence today, and that's not that's not serve us or anybody in the region to have that kind of influence, but that's the reality of where we are today. So I think they'll continue to spread try to spread the revolution. That's why other countries in the region, UAE, has requested a major arms package from the United States. That's why the Saudis have requested a major arms package. Why? Because they're worried about Iran becoming much more expansionist, much more revolutionary, trying to dictate and topple their governments. So that's the tinderbox that we're looking at over in the Middle East, and that's why it's really important for us to impress upon, I say China, because we always talk about the U.S. playing the China card. I think it's time for China to play the China card. You see, I think that China is in a position to go to the Iranians and say, we're serious. We get oil from you, and that's real important to us. But we don't want to see you get a nuclear weapon. They've said this publicly, they've said it privately. They know what the consequences could be long term if Iran gets nuclear weapons. So I think they're in a position quietly to go to the Iranians and say, no, we're serious, and we're going to join for more intensive sanctions against you. That certainly is not going to bode well for you or for your leadership or your country. I think the Russians have the same obligation, and if the Chinese were involved, I think the Russians would similarly be involved, because the Russians don't want to see them get a nuclear weapon. So here we have every country, India, China, Russia, us, Germany, France, et cetera, Great Britain, all saying, let's not get a nuclear weapon. But I think China has a major role to play, because I think the Iranians think if they can split the UN Security Council, then they are home free. That China will not support the United States, Russia won't support the United States, they'll be able to continue to do what they're doing, and they'll bear the penalty in terms of the economic sanctions. Although you've seen this week, those sanctions are biting harder and harder against the Iranian economy. I think if they bite hard enough, Iran might recalculate and say, we've made our point, and we have the intellectual capability to develop these systems. We're not going to do so. We're instead going to use it for peaceful nuclear purposes. And the Russians have given the Iranians a perfect opportunity to do that. We have all said, you have a right to develop nuclear power for civilian and peaceful purposes. And the Russians have said, we'll reprocess, we'll enrich the uranium. And so we'll control it. You'll get the power that you need to produce pharmaceuticals and whatever else you want to produce. And the Iranians have said no. So I think that the Russians and the Chinese can really come in, and if they do so, you won't see the kind of military confrontation that the Israelis have been threatening and might one day feel they have no choice but to execute.
Again, the two candidates on Iran. President Obama has come up with the strongest sanctions we've ever had in the history of our country. What Governor Romney said today is he wants stronger sanctions. Is there any difference between the
Well, wanting them and getting them is two separate things. I mean, we've been pretty successful to date in getting sanctions imposed against the Iranians, having the Europeans, certainly, who had a much closer relationship to Iran than we have, getting the Chinese to sign on to them, getting the Russians to sign on, not the one as intense as we would like. But it's one thing to say we're going to get more intense sanctions. You have to get them. And I think that only through diplomacy will that take place. And then there's that threat that's out there. The Israelis keep looking at it. They see things differently than we do. They're closer. And so they're looking existentially at a threat that is very close to their borders. So they have a different timeline. They have a different different reaction to all of this. They say, that's great for you, the United States. You're way over here. We're right here. So they feel the pressure much more intensely, and they might feel compelled. Even though there's great disagreement in Israel, there's great disagreement in the military, with their intelligence officials, that this is not a wise thing to do at this time. You saw the 60 Minutes piece a couple of weeks ago. The former head of the Mossad said it would be unwise for them to take military action, he said, at this time, because there are other things that can be done to forestall what the Iranians are seeking to do. So I don't think that that Governor Romney is prepared to say, I would urge the Israelis to take military action. I will green light and say, whatever you want, we will support. I don't think he's gone that far, and frankly, I hope he doesn't go that far, because I think we have to be in charge of when we're being committed to another military campaign and not have somebody else make that determination for us. We have to work with the Israelis, and frankly, I've said this publicly, it's no secret from me. I would hope that if the Israelis ever decide they're going to take military action, that we are advised of this appropriately, and it's not a solo operation on their part with no notice to us. We have real issues involved, real people at risk, real consequences that we will have to bear. So I hope, because they are our ally and a strong ally, that we always act in concert in terms of making sure we don't get blindsided by something where we have long-term consequences and immediate consequences involved. The Israelis publicly have said, well, they won't commit to telling us because they want to insulate us against the criticism that we are the ones who are urging them to do it. I don't accept that. I think that they have to keep us apprised whatever they're going to do in the future.
In the region, would it be really seen as a distinction without a difference whether the attack was an Israeli attack with our support or without?
No, I think the United States will, whatever takes place, will be held as the party who either encouraged it or could have stopped it. So I think that whatever action is taken, we will be seen as the principals involved.
With respect to the Israeli-Palestinian relationship and the possibilities for peace, there are two ways in which Governor Romney has differed with everyone who's been president thus far. One is that he's referred to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And two, he seems to have distanced himself from the notion that a peace agreement would be based on the pre-67 borders. Say something about that. What is your expectation should Governor Romney become president?
Well, he has said that he would recognize Jerusalem as being the capital. We have always said, the Republican and Democratic administrations have always taken the position this is subject to negotiation as far as the peace agreement. And I think that's the wiser course of action rather than to dictate that or declare that at this point. But today he said in his presentation that he favored a two-state solution. I think that's the first time that he has said that. And frankly, I've been out on front on this for a long time. I think there absolutely has to be a Palestinian state. It has to, I mean, look at the Palestinians. You say, what do the Israelis need? The Israelis need security. They cannot have a hostile nation on their borders in a position to rain warfare down on their heads within seconds. And so that's a given. They need security. Palestinians, what do they need? They need sovereignty. They need dignity. They need economic opportunity. I think that is the essence of what has to come about through a peace process. Frankly, I'm more discouraged about it than ever. I have not seen much progress being made. Tomorrow I will see my friend George Mitchell. He and I are going to, I guess, debate tomorrow. George Mitchell is one of the most serious-minded, one of the most capable individuals I've ever known. He certainly was successful in northern Iran, Ireland, rather. And he said something. I was there the day that President Obama picked him to be the envoy to the Middle East. Senator Mitchell got up and said, well, during the negotiations with Northern Ireland, there was something like 730-odd days of no and one day of yes. And that was an indication he was prepared to sit there as long as necessary. Well, he sat there for almost 2 years and finally gave up. Saying it's time to turn it over to somebody else because no one was making any movements. The Palestinians were not putting their act together. You didn't have a united or unified front. The Israelis were not willing to give up much during that process, so you had both parties staying exactly where they are today. So I'm not that optimistic. I think it's important. I think it's imperative there be a two-state solution because otherwise Israel will no longer be a democratic state in the sense that one man, one vote, because the Arab population will soon outnumber them substantially. And if you get one man, one vote, then obviously that's not going to work to their interest. So this is not me talking. This is Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak, who was the former, he is the defense minister today. He was the former prime minister. He came to the United States and said, we are facing, if we don't do this, being an apartheid country. Now, Jimmy Carter got in a lot of trouble for using that word. But here you have Ehud Barak, who has said, unless we have a two-state solution, we're going to end up as an apartheid state where you'll have Palestinians over here with fewer rights than Israelis have here. So that's something they have to contend with. And hopefully, over the next, hope is it springs eternal. I hope so.
Time is close to run out, and I haven't had a chance to ask you about Pakistan, which is probably the hardest foreign policy and national security problem. Do you have a word to say about that before I turn to the last question?
I think you described it. It's the hardest problem we have to contend with. It's very fragile. It's a very difficult situation where the Pakistanis, they have terrorist groups within. They still fear the relationship with India. They've had several wars fought with India. And so on the one hand, they are a, quote, democracy, but in a very fragile situation economically and politically. They have challenges from within, and of course we have challenges we're imposing from without because we're launching strikes into Pakistan. So that creates internal problems for them. And when we kill people, even when we kill terrorists, but we kill innocent people as well, so-called collateral damage, that creates enormous problems for them. I think that they were trying to preserve their sense of authority when we were able to kill bin Laden. That was a mission carried out without their knowledge. And so you have a U.S. force going into their space, taking out bin Laden, which we all hail as a major success. I'll tell you one other quick story about Pakistan, then I'll yield the floor to a question in the audience. We tried to get bin Laden as well in the Clinton years. We had only one, basically, what we thought was a clear shot. And it wasn't very clear. Because at that time, you may recall, we had no bases anywhere in the region. We didn't have any base in Afghanistan. We didn't have any bases in Pakistan. We didn't have any bases in Kazakhstan, anywhere. So we're basically out in the ocean. And we had some intelligence that came through that said bin Laden is going to be at this place in Afghanistan. Well, you say, well, how long is he going to be there? Because he has, his modus operandi was to keep moving every few hours. Well, you can't fire a missile from hundreds of miles away if the person is going to be moving all the time. So we had to have some pretty good intelligence that he was going to be at a certain spot. Well, problem. How do you fire a missile to take out bin Laden in Afghanistan without overflying Pakistan? And that's the problem we had to contend with. And fortunately, we had General Joseph Ralston, who happens to be, he was the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs. He's now the vice chair of the Cohen Group as well. But we sent him on a mission to Pakistan to meet with his counterpart, have dinner. And he was there and was there when our missiles are flying over Pakistani territory. Now, the risk for that was if we didn't have him there sitting there, if the Pakistanis detected missiles coming over, they would have to know where they're coming from. Are they coming from India or where? And so there are real dangers involved. So we've tried to, on the one hand, deal with Pakistan in terms of treating them as a democratic country that's an ally of the United States. At the same time, be willing to risk compromising a mission such as bin Laden. So it created enormous problems internally for them. And they were embarrassed by it. And so they were trying, and they've done some things, taken some actions, which haven't presented them in a very positive light with us. So the issue is, how do we contend, how do we still deal with this country? Because a failed Pakistan is not in anybody's interest. So we've got to continue to engage them, even though there are things that are said and done that we don't like and want to discourage them from engaging. And nonetheless, this is what diplomacy is all about. This is why it's so hard. This is why you can't reduce it to sound bites and you can't just declare I'm for this or for that. You have to say, how complex is it and what are the things we have to do to try to resolve it? Anyway.
I'm going to end with a question that flows wonderfully from the first question.
Okay.
And that question comes from a younger person asking, how can we restore young people's enthusiasm about public service, be it serving as a civilian in government, serving in the military, public service overall?
Well, number one, get involved in the public process, the political process. Go work for either a local candidate in the city council. I started off as a city council. Well, I started off before that, but I ran for the city council. I was elected to the school board, and I was elected mayor in a small city, Bangor, Maine. But that's what I did as a very young man. So I got involved at the local level, and then an opportunity came for me to run for office at the higher level, and was fortunate enough to get elected. But to the young people who are here, to the ones who are either watching or listening, get involved. This is your country. And you can say it's all, it's all polarized and it's something I don't want to get involved with. Well, people will make decisions whether you're involved or not. You'd rather be involved and help them make the right decision. So young people have an obligation to get involved at the earliest age as possible. Volunteer. Do whatever you can for a candidate that you think supports the values that you share. And then eventually run for office and make sure that we're accountable. The other thing is make sure that we stay accountable, that if we say something, you hold us to it. And this is one thing you have to be careful of. We're watching presidential campaigns. Be careful what you say. Understand that you have to appeal to, quote, your base. But you can't make statements that you are then going to have to reject once you get in office, because it undermines your credibility if you don't adhere to them. So. I think find a candidate that you support at the state level, local level, at the
senatorial, congressional level, and the presidential level. Get involved.
Please join me in thanking former Secretary William Cohen. Thank you.